Hello and welcome to today's program in the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Open Source Housing for Good. Our panelists are Brewster Kahle, who is the founder of Alexa and also the head librarian at the Internet Archive. Kevin Jones is the founder of the Hub Network, the Impact Hub Network. He is the man behind the SOCAP conference and the various related conferences about that. And he is a man who lives in several different locations and has a very interesting story about that. Jessie Kate Shingler is our final speaker. She is the founder of the Embassy Network. She has a very interesting story about co-housing around the world. And she and her organization have recently purchased the Red Victorian in the Haight and are doing some very interesting things here. So with that, I would like to introduce you to our first speaker who's going to open this up, and each of our speakers will speak for about 6 or 7 minutes, and then we will have some discussion with the audience and with the panelists and with me. So let me turn it over now to Brewster Kahle.
Thank you, Kevin. So as he said, I'm a founder and digital librarian of the Internet Archive, and it's from that place that I'm going to be coming at the housing issue. I'm going to be talking about foundation housing. Our employees are being driven from their homes by rising rents. They're being put over an hour away because of the lack of affordable housing, and they're living in insecurity because of fluctuating rents and house prices. I believe it's becoming harder for nonprofits to be able to attract and keep really good people, the Internet Archive included, because of this problem. We did a survey, and our employees spend between 30 and 60% of their income on housing. 30 to 60%. That's a whole lot more than the HUD's recommended less than 25%. And this is turns out that it's not just the Internet Archive or nonprofit workers, and it's not just the Bay Area. It turns out, according to this Harvard study of renters, 30 to 60% is average in the United States, which is kind of frightening. And for homeowners, it's often up in that range, except for those that are lucky enough, or very few, that own their houses outright. In the Bay Area, it's particularly problematic because the rents and housing prices have been rising really fast. And so it's causing dislocations. It's causing people to cling on to their apartments and to their jobs in sort of unnatural ways. Nonprofits are particularly hard hit because their funding generally doesn't go up and down as fast as market-based organizations. Also, when the market is down is exactly when you want nonprofit services to be strong. And it's often exactly not the case. So at the Internet Archive, and I'd say other nonprofits, we've got an existential problem, which is affordable and stable employee housing. The Internet Archive and the Kahle Austin Foundation have tried a model that I'd like to discuss today to try to help with this, foundation housing. So the idea of the foundation housing is to create a nonprofit called the Foundation House that has been set up to purchase apartment buildings. These rental units are then made available to employees at select nonprofits at a debt-free rate, basically the equivalent of a condominium fee in the taxes. So in other words, if you remove the cost of debt from a building, the underlying cost of maintenance, taxes, and insurance is about one-third of the cost of running a building. So one-third is these other costs, two-thirds is debt. So if you have a debt-free building, then you can have employees, in our case, live there for a fee of about one-third of market rent. And we believe it to be more stable than market-based rent. So it's low and it's more stable. Currently, this is being tried, which is kind of fun. And we bought in a building. So we've got an 11-unit building in San Francisco near the Internet Archive. to try this approach out. As apartments have become available, as renters have been moving out, we don't force tenants out. They just move out by attrition. Then the Foundation House has made these available to employees of two different nonprofits. And there are now three employees that are living there. Having a walking commute, having lower housing costs, and a nice neighborhood has been actually pretty attractive. And two of them, actually, are in the audience. Roxana used to commute for over an hour each way to an apartment in Bayview on three different buses, and raising her eight-year-old daughter in a building that had active drug deals going on meant that it was kind of a hazardous place to be. Now she gets to walk six blocks to work, and she pays less, so she's kind of happy about that. Michelle is a young librarian who was being evicted from her apartment and would have had to have left San Francisco. It's just, you know, at this point, if you leave your apartment, it's like one of the worst things that can happen because you just can't afford a new one again. And Samantha, worried about her rent would increase, and she is basically calculating that she only had 3 or 4 years left in San Francisco to go before she would have to move out of San Francisco and maybe leave her job as well. But in what she says, she really likes, lower rent, but also being in a community instead of just neighbors. Mm-hmm. So it really sort of feels like more of a place to be. Having housing provided by as an employee benefit is similar to faculty housing. Military monasteries do this, and some hospitals have their own housing. But having to leave your apartment upon leaving your job, it's not so great. Right, so that's a negative in this particular model. We haven't had to deal with that particular thing because it's so new, but it's not an up a positive sort of point towards this new model. But we think we now have a model. We're trying to figure out how to make it permanent and how we can finance it. To make it permanent, we're borrowing some of the ideas from the open source world. The open source software world had this concept of a writer would voluntarily say, I'm going to have only some rights reserved, not all rights reserved. I'm going to basically give up some potential profitability on the upside in return for having more community participation in my software. So this idea of a license that's an irrevocable license to a work, in this case software, was one idea. We thought, could we apply this to housing? Could we go and take the idea of a license, an irrevocable license, and apply it to buildings and apply it to nonprofit owners? And in what we're giving up with this license is the ability for the owner to flip the building. So make it so you can't basically just flip it and make a profit out of it. You're basically dedicating the building forever to the public good. And if it doesn't stay, if the building falls down or something like that, then you have some mechanism such that the people making the decision to deal with it don't profit from it. So the idea is to try to take the profit out of flipping buildings to be able to have a permanent asset for good. To finance the creation of these, we've got four ideas, and we're actually trying at some levels three of the ideas. And so one of them is we actually built a credit union, and we started building a credit union 4 years ago because we wanted to be able to go and do financing of interesting housing projects that are more community based. And we built it. It's called the Internet Credit Union. It's terrific. But we've learned a lot about the regulators of credit unions, which are controlled by the banks. They don't really like new credit unions that much. And the idea of our new credit union being able to do mortgages, we can't do them yet, even though the credit union's been around for a couple of years. So maybe someday. Then we tried the endowment approach. So could we basically go and buy a building like this with a pitch to a major donor as a form of endowment for nonprofits? Often, people will endow nonprofits, and that what really will happen is they'll put that money into, like, Goldman Sachs. And then Goldman Sachs goes and does whatever magic it does and spins off some interest to the underlying nonprofit. So instead of putting it money in a bank account, what if we put the money in something that would be actively useful to the nonprofits that the donor wants to serve, sort of bypassing the whole bank part of the process? And that's actually how we ended up buying this particular building. So, well, we got two more ideas. So that's one approach. And it actually, it's financially, it makes sense as an endowment, and you're able to give long-term solidity to the nonprofits you're trying to serve. So I think actually in terms of the mindset of what endowments are originally for, the idea of not only having the nonprofit own the building they work in, but the building their employees live in makes both financial sense and stability sense. So we came up with another idea, which we haven't done yet, which is could we raise a fund, say a bond, that kind of thing, either from cities, states, private investors, to go and buy a building. Say we raised a bond for $100 million, bought a set of these buildings, and then kept them with market-based renters. Market-based renters can pay back mortgage. So if you can just have patience, you can pay back the bondholders a real interest rate, maybe not a great interest rate, but some. And that's sort of SOCAP kind of idea of social capital, that you're interested in getting some return. You get your money back. But over time, the building will eventually transition into being debt-free and therefore being foundation housing. So it would be an investment up front, wait for a while, in this case probably 10 to 15 years, and then these buildings would transition into being permanently debt-free foundation housing. Lastly, and another idea for how to do this is something that's going on to a certain extent, and it's actually conversations happening in San Francisco and Oakland and other places like this, where people are saying, I want a different idea, and I'm setting up new housing or co-working spaces that are going to be here for the community, and we want it to be here for the community forever. If we can build a license, like an open source license, like a Creative Commons license, that is how somebody that's going into building one of these shared facilities and say, okay, I'm going to use this license. Then people, foundations might say, okay, I know how to contribute to you. Or maybe that doesn't even require it. It's just the way that the group wants to live, such that there isn't somebody with a bonanza at the end of the day. So group houses, often they pay off their mortgages. But who wins out of that? It's kind of the last person standing. And instead of doing that, why don't we have something that makes it permanently attached to a mission? So we have a first start at how to do permanent, affordable housing for nonprofit workers. And the over 10% of the employees in the United States work in the nonprofit sector. A dream would be 5% of housing. Say if we had 5% of housing as a housing sector that was permanently debt-free for those that are dedicating their lives to service, that we basically make a stable support infrastructure that's not government tied into with government necessarily and not necessarily tied in with churches, but is this sort of nonprofit service sector. I think we could create more debt-free foundation housing for nonprofit workers. Thank you very much. Kevin, you're next.
Okay.
I'm going to fumble here. Why don't you start talking, and I'll see if I can get your slides up.
That'd be great. I've warned a couple people here that this is my first time to talk publicly about our new startup, and it's really harder to talk about a startup that's actually working compared to having vaporware, but we almost have something, but people are already paying us. So, but when this is my ninth turnaround or startup, 7 of 8 have been successful. But when you do that, I may be really geeky and talk really engineering because I figured out how some wheels turn And so, you know, I might be describing how the squirrels start to work on the network, that kind of thing.
Kevin, could you tell
them a little bit about who you are?
Oh, yeah, okay. I build marketplaces, and one of them is called SOCAP, Social Capital Markets, and it's where impact investors and entrepreneurs meet up, and it's the biggest such event. It's content, but it's really where people go to meet people, you know, and if you're looking for funding, that's where people go. We started 8 years ago, and we've grown from 600 to 2,200 or so. We'll be about 2,500. About people come from 60 countries. It's at Fort Mason. My path to, and we also started these impact hubs here, and we own five of them in San Francisco and D.C. and Berkeley and Philadelphia and Tribeca. And we've invested in them in Boulder and L.A. and Oakland and Seattle. And we're getting closer with some of those. And so the hubs are where we call them is where change goes to work. So it's, you know, places where for co-working, for social entrepreneurs, but also small offices, meeting spaces, events and stuff. And they're kind of linked. You know, they're all about, people trying to make change. And then at SOCAP, all the entrepreneurs come, often at a higher level. So sometimes they hire from hub folks. That's all working, and it's doing pretty well. We've hired a CEO this week, and so this is my third time to leave a multimillion-dollar company that has about 30 employees. And when it gets about 30 employees, you know, I need to be leaving. You get things like brand managers who want to keep you on message, and you're trying to figure out something new. And so this is my third time to leave. And, you know, founders are like lettuce, and I reach my sell-by date. So I'm going off and doing new things. One of the things that this came from is people wanted SOCAP in their town. People say, hey, here's $100,000 due SOCAP Istanbul. And we tried it a couple times, and it's real hard to bring your whole team. And then it turned out what they wanted was not an event. They wanted a social capital market, a thriving local economy in their town, where they could see more options, where they had seen barriers and scarcity before. So we're bringing an asset-based community development way of looking at things, because we're working mostly in places where venture capital doesn't work. And we're selling a funding kit, so we'll create more money in your town for good things, because of the way we do that. But our entry to create the network is that we're building a Venture One for local economies. So raise your hand if you know what Venture One is. Okay, two people maybe. So Venture One is what exists in venture capital. It's one of the competitive advantages that Silicon Valley started with. But you can know who funds what and who funds with them, who are their co-investors, who leads, who follows, who partners with who never partners with who, even though they should. And then as an investor, you can find the entrepreneurs that are getting some funding that you want to go into, or you can find everybody who's could potentially be co-investing with you. So it makes everybody really smart, really fast, and it eliminates the friction around money in your sector. We're building that for local economies. We're starting from a database coming out of a platform coming out of the Urban Institute that will tell you for any county, where is everybody giving? To what churches, to what nonprofits, where are they giving it from, in what categories? It'll tell you all that stuff. We're building two things around that. Local Wiki is part of it. That's a whole network open source thing that's really democratic. So you can put the non-structured data around knowing, you know, that this nonprofit got this funding. And you know, often the nonprofits don't know all the funders in their area. And then we're here this week vetting social network visualization to link to the database, link to the wiki, so that you could find the patterns. I mean, visualization is often just eye candy and doesn't do anything. But in the Venture One like space, you can really find who your partner should be and what funders you should be looking at. And we'll also populate it with the big level funders of local economies, the folks who fund the Bali Conference and the Slow Money Conference and those sorts of things that fund levels of infrastructure around that. So you can go upstream. So, and because of the design constraints around the database, they only want to sell it in units of six. So we have three counties that we're already working with, one of whom already has the database, and all the software is coming out of Allentown. And we're building, you know, a resilient small town and city network. And so we're going to deploy that in Yancey County, which is a rural southern Appalachian town that has what our customer set looks, has a certain look. We don't build communities. We come into smart communities where there's already a circle of people, some people of means, thinking systemically, working on, it often comes out of food. People get conscious about food, and then they start thinking about systems, and then they think about inclusion. So there's, you know, there's a big jump from farm to table to food desert. So folks don't usually associate that much, but they get there. If we find groups that are doing that are talking to poor folks, not just talking about poor folks, they're ready for what we're doing. And so there's a county that I live in, Asheville, that has a real articulate food system, food shed, in a local food policy network that we're going to work with to give them these tools, and we're going to pattern it after how it's already working in Allentown, and then we're going to sort of conduct a bake-off of other counties that are near us that want to be in a peer learning network. We'll give you the software. We're paying for the software, the licensing, and some of it is open source. But your ante is you have to really show up about wanting to be in a peer network. And so there's some places that are over toward Raleigh that are far, far ahead of everybody, but we want to make it convenient. So they have to really, they'll be kind of pitching us. And the neat thing is we don't know much, but we have a tool that'll make them smarter faster if they commit to being on this network. And because the problems of building these local food sheds are kind of the same. And then once we get on the network, you know, phase two is we can produce more money for good things in your community because of the tools we have. And that's just some simple stuff that we don't need to talk about, because the first step is if you want to be in a peer learning network, get smarter. We've got some software for you, and people are paying to be part of the network. You know, Cincinnati, Allentown, Yancey County, and we haven't sold Asheville yet, but we'll, you know, we will. Once you have the information operating system, selling is pretty simple. So that's what we're doing. The odd thing is nobody's done this, and we're not real sure what we're doing, but people are paying us even though we hadn't done it. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, thank you, Kevin Jones. And now I'd like to introduce Jesse Kate Shingler. I'm sorry about that.
Thanks for having me. This is really exciting to be on a panel with Brewster in particular, who's been a big supporter of our project in San Francisco, and to hear more about Kevin's projects as well. I think we're all familiar with the impact that they've had on the city here. I'm here to talk about two different projects. One is some work that we're doing locally in San Francisco, and the other is how that relates to a project that we're doing to connect together spaces that are similar to ours globally across the world. Currently, there's actually several members of our community here in the audience today. Zarina and Eric and Misha have been a part of our community for a long time. We've got two locations that we're working together to run in San Francisco. These are communities, residential communities, but we combine short, medium, and long-term housing together in one large community. So for us, what we're trying to look at is how is the need for housing changing in the modern world, and how can we recognize how people's lives are changing in the modern world and provide housing that's kind of acknowledging of technology, of culture, of community. We find that people are isolated a lot of the time in communities and cities in the world today, and they're very mobile. And so as they flow between city to city, they want to find somewhere to plug in that actually feels like home. And so that's where the multiple sort of tiers of duration come in. The interesting thing about doing that is that we end up having a revenue stream for our communities. So the guests that come and stay with us provide an income source to our community, which does several things. It allows us to keep our long-term resident rent low. It allows us to put money towards events and activities that are open to the public. So we end up having a very active, dynamic space where we have lots of people coming in for talks and things that are kind of similar to this. It also allows us to provide jobs to some people in our community. which means that we're actually creating even more of a mixed income housing environment, which I think is really important for San Francisco, as I'm sure we could get into. So I think it's neat because, kind of piggybacking on top of the models that Brewster is talking about, we have something that's a nonprofit model, but we have a revenue stream as well. And the people who are coming to stay with us, excuse me, they're not just coming to stay at a hotel or an Airbnb that's sort of a, you know, room in the back that you can make some additional money off of, but they're actually plugging into a community of people who are, you know, living and breathing San Francisco. They're connecting about projects that they're working on. They're mutually supporting one another, inspiring one another. And that's great for the residents because the residents are getting to constantly meet new people and reach out to kind of new communities and connect about what they're working on. And as a community, if for those of you who have lived in large communities before, it's easy to get kind of a little bit navel-gazing and become insular over time as you become really comfortable in your community. And so having a constant influx of people into our houses means that we kind of are reminded to be focused on the bigger picture of the world around us. Similarly, for guests, we think and we hope that they get to really meet kind of real human beings who are up to interesting things in San Francisco. So after getting going with this model that we've been doing here in San Francisco, we also realized that there's actually a lot of places like this around the world, large community spaces that are mixed use, that have a lot of events coming through them. They often have guest spaces as well. And these are people who really stand for making a difference in the world. And what if we had a platform that could connect these spaces together so that as those of us who are moving around the world for projects and collaborations did so, we could go and stay and kind of be embedded in communities of people who are actively trying to make a difference. And so we have this software platform that is doing that for several places in the Bay Area currently, and we're beginning to reach out to locations that are elsewhere around the world. That's basically a global network of shared housing for people who are working on new ideas. And the platform, I guess, focuses on two things. One is that facilitation of mobility. And we have various ways that people are plugging into our communities with half-time residential memberships, medium-term housing, of course, the short-term housing I mentioned, and the long-term. But the other thing that we're beginning to experiment with is the creation of what we call a housing commons. So as more people bring their houses, their communities into the network, we can each contribute some amount of our housing resources to one another and make it possible to trade, kind of in a couch surfing-esque way. But it's kind of an analogy to the open source world or to the software world, the creation of a protocol for housing, for mobility. This is something we're just starting to experiment with, but it's been a lot of fun. And I think we're really, you know, we're curious about connecting with other creative communities in other countries. We're working with a community in Haiti right now. We're working with a group in Philadelphia, in Bali. So we've got a few that are that we hope will be kind of interesting spaces for people who are here to go and embed themselves in those communities in the same way that people have been embedding themselves in our communities. And really our goals are to make housing affordable and easy and inspiring. So, thank you.
Can I ask Jesse a question?
Yeah.
Jesse, can you just be
very specific
about the two houses that you... Yeah. Can you describe the two San Francisco houses and sort of how big are they? What are they? What do they look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So to be specific, the first house that kind of got this all going was a smallish mansion in Cupertino called Rainbow Mansion, which sort of started with a bunch of NASA, Google, you know, very, very tech focused. A bunch of us were very young, kind of living together, and realized though that we had the potential to do more with the housing that we were creating. So when we came to the city, we figured that we were kind of starting to grow up a little bit. We wanted to provide more professional accommodations to people, but we also wanted to see what we could do in terms of using the financial model that we had to create this balance. So We have a house that's in the Lower Haight. It's called the Embassy San Francisco, and it's a 10-bedroom house. It's a very kind of large, opulent, over-the-top, beautifully restored Victorian mansion. We have a lot of common space, many different rooms for people to have events in. We've got a music room. We have a big dining room. We frequently have dinner parties. We do salons, as I mentioned, and we have co-working space. So it's a very dynamic, flexible space. We have, I think, 3 guest rooms. So we have anywhere from sort of 15 to 20 people in the house at any given time. The economics, maybe we'll get into that later, but become really interesting because I would say one of the, mild digression, but one of the interesting things about communal housing is that I think we'll often say it's cheaper than regular housing. And that can be the case, but a lot of the time with the bigger communal spaces, you have a lot of common space as well that's shared by people in the community. So your absolute cost is often not necessarily lower, but what you get for that cost is much higher. So in terms of, you know, real estate and financing and cost per square foot, and you're making more per square foot if you're thinking in terms of, you know, real estate investing. Your people are paying less per square foot that they have access to, but then they have access to all this space to organize events and to, you know, have meetings and to kind of leverage to make the impact with the projects that they're working on that they want. The other space is the Red Victorian, which Kevin mentioned. We don't actually own the building, but we have a very generous long-term lease on the building. And our landlords are also nonprofit, and they're very excited about us being able to provide a community-focused space in the Upper Haight. As you guys know, there's not that many of them left anymore. And the exciting thing about the Red Victorian is that it's not the movie theater, by the way. That's a block down the street. But we have about 2,000 square feet of commercial space on the ground floor, and we have a restaurant license. So we've also got 20 rooms upstairs. 10 of the rooms are long-term residents, and 10 are for short and medium-term residents. So we have a very dynamic kind of cross-section of people coming into and out of the space. And then the commercial space is a community space where it's kind of a community-supported space. So we've got memberships. For $150 or $200 a month, you basically have access to host events there, to use it as sort of your home away from home. It could be for co-working, it could be for music events, art shows. We just opened an art show for the first Thursday last week. And so the idea is, you know, that creates this commons, this sort of micro commons in the Upper Haight that then we can go and, you know, we have a lot of kind of creative and interesting events that are open to the public. That people in the neighborhood can enjoy as well.
A couple questions. What's the age diversity? How many people are my or Brewster's generation versus yours?
We've been trying to find people who will come live with us, but we haven't so far. I mean, it's okay. Definitely, you know, it's higher density than I have found. Mm-hmm. People of your generation are mm-hmm. necessarily excited about, but. I mean, I think there's...
And what are they moving out of? Are they moving out of a place where they had a mortgage or a lease? Or what are they moving out of to this?
Do you guys want to comment? Well, actually, I mean, I would say when I started doing this, we were all coming out of college. But now most of us are sort of, you know, early career, I would say. So kind of mid to late 30s. You know, I don't know. Do you guys want to say where you came from? Zarina's a professor at...
Oh, sorry. What did I say? I came from London, and I previously owned a one-bedroom apartment in London, so I went from living in solitary confinement, if you like. then I lived in a housecoat community, and then I came to San Francisco, so not out of college. Yeah, I'm a scientist.
Yeah, I moved into the Rainbow Mansion after grad school, have been in communal housing since, and I think that another interesting case is that people come from sharing apartments with people, but it's different to just have housemates versus being in a community. And so I've seen people that come from, you know, you're in a 3-bedroom apartment and there's 3 people living there, but it's a very different experience coming into a place like the Embassy or the Rainbow Mansion, and it's something that people crave more than just it's a better deal. It's a better experience.
Okay, I would like to, I'm sorry. How's my level now? Okay, good. I would like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Open Source Housing for Good. Our panelists are Brewster Kahle, Kevin Jones, and Jesse Kate Shingler. Now we're going to continue with some audience questions.
So I think what you guys are doing is pretty amazing, especially for it just reminds me a lot of the artist communities that were built in New York, which is great. But I think that I would hope it would extend more beyond this, and we'd extend to individuals that actually are working class families living and contributing. Well, actually not living; they're actually contributing to the economy of the city, but not able to live in the city. And which are mostly minorities and people with English as a second language. And so I think that we have to go beyond that because, you know, I work in a lot of different major cities and I work with a lot of different cities. And for me, just to see the lack of ability of people that are minorities or people that have English as a second language, the ability of them to not be able to have a secure home is just as equally as important. So I would love to hear your comments on that.
I totally agree, and especially as people in our communities. I mean, I'm a English speaking white person, but we definitely have several people in our communities who have left because they are starting families, and. What I would love to see is essentially, you know, taking over like a large apartment building and taking the ground floor, you know, leaving the apartment units pretty much intact so people still have a little bit more sort of private space, and to your question as well, a little bit more private space and flexibility with how they use their own space, but then use the ground floor space as sort of a big shared kitchen and common meeting space. So it's sort of a hybrid of like what Rains and Betsy are doing with co-housing, which is an awesome model. It really is co-housing, but in an urban kind of apartment context. I would hope that would be accessible to the groups that you're talking about. I think that what we need, I think the model is there. I think we need to start building community housing that isn't just for kind of young, quote unquote, single people. I mean, I live with my husband in our community, but.
But then you need to develop an outreach program that actually attracts those individuals, right? That's something that reaches out to them, where. You know, you have a place to go. I mean, it's very similar to the whole charter school
dilemma that exists within this country, and where, you know, if you are a parent does not take the time to care about your student's education, you're not going to seek out a charter school. So there needs to be outreach programs that attract those individuals that actually know that, you know, there's housing here available to you.
Yeah, that's an excellent idea.
Well, thank you. I'd like to ask one question for all three of our panelists. So how does this relate to equity? Do people in each of your situations, do the people living there, are they like renters? Are they investors? How does it all shake out in the end? Brewster, why don't you start?
In the model that we've been developing, it's much more like renters, so that you move in with no fee and you move out getting no bonanza at the end. My parents my father worked in a Fortune 500 company for his whole life, and just the house he lived in appreciated so much in value. He said he made much more on the house than his retirement benefits from a Fortune 500. And that seems like a great idea unless you're the next generation. So you can't have just sort of everybody's a bonanza, everybody's getting rich. Somebody's paying that money, and I don't have a mechanism of thinking of how do you go and have bonanzas and have this. But there's a different aspect of equity, which is some feeling like you're controlling your own house or your own destiny, not having a landlord that can kick you out at any time. And what I'd love to see out of the foundation housing is to try to accomplish that through some sort of constitutions right? So that you basically, you know what the rules are of how it runs. It's not arbitrary. We're not there yet. Actually, Michelle and Roxana, they're having to put up with sort of a little bit of guinea pigness. It's like, well, we're still trying this thing out. But the idea is to try to stabilize it so it becomes a known idea of what happens. So it takes the arbitrariness out of rental life. But we haven't figured out how to make everybody rich and have no one get poorer at the end of the day.
Well, Kevin, what's your model with for individual ownership or...
Well, we're a funding kit, so for communities where venture capital doesn't work, and with our tools, it's a mix of giving and through giving circles, you know, trusted groups, your Sunday school class, your book club, your Sierra Club group that meets, doing giving, and then doing investing below market. And then the third thing is philanthropic investing through a donor advised fund, so you get a deduction, and so then you can invest long term in things you would never be able to do that with if you it was a traditional loan. So we think that's what will unleash a whole lot of money to do good, because it will also cause people to think differently about their money, to act that way. They'll act their way into a new way of thinking, and we think there's a real magic around linking the three of them. All three of these tools exist, but nobody's linked them. And if you look at them, and we get people to answer the question of, here am I, and here's my family, and what kind of community do I want to live in? And that means, what do I give to, and what do I lend to in a way that will be better than a bank? And then what do I do this other long-term thing around philanthropic investing? And in that, we have it's a kind of a cute little thing. How many people here did savings bonds when they were a kid in school? And yeah, you put them in a little envelope, you know, and suddenly you get $25 U.S. savings bond. We're building a local biocultural resilience bond that kids will put, you know, a dollar into, but it'll be where they'll be selling that bond to the community, and the kids will have the long term view, and the parents will get a dividend from a food hub like thing that'll have a co-op. And so there'll be abundance to share across generations, with the kids having the long-term view and the parents wanting to say, no, I need it to pay the bills. So it's a real interesting dynamic around that. I mean, we're building in a biodiversity market by a guy who knows how to build one, because he's done them for set-asides for pipelines. And, you know, if you have a pipeline, then you have to manage for the prairie hen and the upper prairie, and then you have good watershed. He's going to do that locally. And so we'll be able to, you know, we're managing to more margin per acre in rural places, so that our goal is that smart kids can move back. You know, that's really what we're for the boomers. It's a grandchild acquisition strategy. That's the whole. You know, it's nice that the kids move back, but it's great that the grandkids. So everybody is pretty much buying into, you know, let's solve brain drain through creating an economy that smart kids can move back, and we're doing it in places where money doesn't flow much. So those are the constraints around that.
Thank you, Kevin Jones. And Jesse Kate, what is the model of ownership for your organization?
So at the moment, the spaces that we're operating are, we rent them. So the financial model for us is we have this fixed cost every month that goes towards paying our rent. And then what's left over, basically, after we pay our expenses is we decide as a community in both locations how that money is spent. And what we've started to do recently is use a newer tool that's available. It's called CoBudget. And I'm not sure if people are familiar with some of the kind of participatory democracy work that has happened in like Porto Alegre, Venezuela. South America has done some really neat stuff in terms of engaging their citizens in participating in allocation of kind of municipal and federal budgets. And so we're basically taking some lessons from them and using a direct allocation method where our residents, as well as medium-term guests, people who stay longer than a month, are basically given a share of whatever we have left over. And said there's essentially a number of projects, and they're also invited to propose those projects. And then everybody can look at the list of proposals. And so say we've got $5,000 left over, and we've got 10 people in the house, right? So each person gets $500, and you've got this list of projects that you can put your money into. And I might say, well, I want to do something that's going to cost $5,000. You might say you're going to do something that's going to cost $20. But it's this method of transparently allocating our resources together towards things that we commonly value. And that's been really fun.
Okay, we have a question.
Okay. Hi, I'm going to... I loved Kevin's description of where you live or how you live. because what I think the found housing aspect could maybe look at is the importance, block by block or neighborhood by neighborhood, of the multi-generational interactions that take place. Probably I'm interested as I get older and say, well, you know, who and how and where shall I maintain the network of a variety of people that I have. There is a network. It's Village something or other.
Where?
Edgerton Village.
Opportunity Village.
No, it's I think it's in Mass. The Village Movement. Beacon Village. Okay, so where people are able to pool their resources. Some of us already own houses. Mm. Some of us have great sweat equity potential, and that the foundation is about people giving back and forth to each other with the skills and options that they possess. And that becomes part of the foundation in a building or on a neighborhood and so on. And I think I'd love to see San Francisco start to take on that model because it has this incredible diversity from, you know, those who are very wealthy to those who own houses to boomers to real elders to children to college graduates and so on. People looking for work, can't find work, but have a lot of eagerness to help and be part of a community and would like to have some grandparent-type people around, you know, and be able to drive them to the store or they could share tickets with them to a performance and so on. So there's a lot more to it than just, I think, the economic flat line. There's more the values shared line among generations that's going to perpetuate a civil society or towards a civil society.
You're here.
I just want to mention that a really cool project that was sort of made the rounds recently, I think in the Netherlands, of a community housing. Do you guys remember the name? I don't know if you saw it, but they're doing a particular, I think they're specifically targeting university students and seniors and having them live together. Sure, it's a step, you know, and I think it was a really cool model that I thought it was going to have.
One thing we're doing intergenerationally is that we're building the map, starting with the food shed asset map, but then building in some other things around that. We're doing it in a senior center, and the senior center is across the street from the community college where we'll have interns and stuff coming and high school, and then it's next to a 100-acre food shed that where they'll be processing in common kitchens and figure out distribution and stuff. So we're building it intergenerationally. The bond is being developed by some moms in Montreal. Turns out that the kids-led bond needs to be, because we have to figure out all the education around it. I mean, we're designing it to have wise children. So we've got a bunch of moms looking at that issue in a pretty interesting way. And we have a deal that we're looking at that is pretty interesting. There's a movie that is out, Rise of the Eco Warriors, and it's a really cool thing. You can save orangutans and solve, you know, for monoculture by helping stop plantations in New Guinea, stop doing palm oil and get work with indigenous folks on trees that should be brought back that they can make some other money off of, much more per, you know, foot compared to palm oil. But you have to develop markets. The first sugar from that just happened. But it's a really – and there's a full-length movie about it, but then Microsoft has built a lot of curriculum around it. So the kids with their moms will be looking at how they would invest to extend the reach of this thing that's already working. And kids love investing in, you know, saving orangutans. And it started with a – it's called The Rise of the Eco Warriors, and there was a group of teenagers, I think it was paid for by Microsoft and other folks to go figure out the social media thing and the whole system around this. And so it'll be young kids working with older kids who are still part of that network and things. So that's we have an infrastructure around which to build the education that makes the bond make sense. And we got some moms who are trying to work with that. And so even people are trying to helping to fund that too, actually. This is kind of working pretty neat.
So he's asked me to stand. What are your actual rental rates,
And do you use a gift share trade exchange economies? And if so, how do you integrate them?
So for the foundation housing, the junior studio or junior one bedrooms and one bedrooms are $800 and $900, I think, per month. So that's – and that compares to the market-based renters in that building. There are no new ones, but we have them from when we bought the building a couple of years ago. They're in the sort of $2,400, $2,700. I think it's now $3,000. It's sort of what market-based rent for the Richmond district is. So it's about one-third. It's kind of one. It's probably where it is now, and I think as time goes on, it'll become less and less percentage. Biggest thing that would cause the foundation house rates to drop from $800 down to around $300 is if we had the nonprofit tax waiver that you get for being a nonprofit. But I don't know if we'll get that from California. But then it would be sort of $200.
So in, I guess, in the embassy location, we've got rents ranging from about $1,100 to $2,200. And that's sort of for rooms, you know, like the nicest rooms with private bathroom and very large kind of opulent Victorian-ness. And then at the Red Victorian, we've actually got sheets sitting here that are – I'm happy to hand out afterwards, outline our pricing. But for the residential rates, it goes between $1,400 to $1,800 for rooms, depending on the number of qualities, size, and private bathroom and other things. In addition, what we do to pool our costs is in both locations, we charge a flat fee for food and utilities. So at the embassy, it's $375, and at the Red Victorian, it's $400. We buy all the food for everybody. It's all completely shared, even with our guests. And with that money, we, again, like we host, you know, lots of people over for very kind of free-flowing, you know, meals and wine. And we're able to buy much more affordably because we buy wholesale. We buy, you know, bulk. And so it really creates, you know, a lot of community to some of what Bruce was saying.
One thing that was brought up in that question is that sort of the question that I get asked a lot, you know, what about alternative currencies, right? And so as a basic design principle, I don't want to talk about that because we're trying to get people to do one new thing. And Matt Flannery is a friend of mine. He formed Kiva. If you guys know what Kiva is, if you don't, you should. Kiva.org. But he said, I got people to do one new thing, which was to invest online with no interest in microfinance and people who take those loans. And if you try to get people to do two new things, it almost always doesn't work. It's always over-engineered. Everybody who's done Kiva for X Plus has failed. I did one. And it cost me a couple hundred, $250,000 to be wrong in that way. So we're doing this one thing. There's a point at which we will have alternative currencies, and I can imagine it. And it's where when we'll have multiple towns on the network, some of whom don't build things and they just consume things. And we'll price what we do to them differently than somebody who builds on the network. And so when you have multiple transactions that are different, some people are free riders and it's okay that they're consumers. Some people help build it, like Allentown is building the software, we're building the funding kit. Cincinnati doesn't look like they have a tool, but they have money. We're glad to have them. And they want to build some infrastructure, but we will probably charge them more than we would charge Allentown because we are co-creating part of the thing with Allentown. You know, what do you have that goes across the network? By the time we get to Allentown, which will be after that, we'll start thinking about currency, but you don't want to design a second thing until you get the first thing working. I've failed at that once, and I will not make that error in this startup. So,
it's very exciting to hear about your innovations in the sector and in new ways of building community. But I'm curious about what you see as differences. What's the reason to bring these in versus existing structures like a land trust? You know, I know SFCLT has been innovating, like Echo Villages, Kevin, like co-ops that are out there and maybe lesser known. But how do you how do you see those as not serving the same needs, and what's worth going much further and innovating differently?
I think one of the big differences for the Foundation House is the commitment to forever. That 100 years ago, there were a lot of buildings that were built in New York to serve the unions, guilds, poor people that were getting smudged by the capitalist system back then. You know, the jungle was actually true. Dickens, that was not fiction in the details. It was horrible. And so there were wonderful buildings that were built. But if you look at them now, they're all full of bankers. And what happened? And I haven't quite figured it all out, but I think what happened is that they were built, they ran for a while, serving the communities they were wanted to serve, and then the boards, which were controlled by the people that were residents, and they said, I've got an idea. Why don't we just sell out? Why don't we buy the equity and release the equity, whatever the rationale at the time was. And people said, gosh, who's in favor of getting rich really quick? It's like, hooray! And so they all got rich really quick, and it's now full of, people that spend $1 million for a condo, and it doesn't serve the original purpose. So what I'd love to do is try to set something on a course that has it built right from the start. And I think actually Richard Stallman with open source software really had to think that through, because his idea of open source software was built in the forge of conflict, that there was real problems that he was trying to solve. And he built that idea very carefully to last. And it has lasted very well with a bunch of people trying to tear it to shreds. If we can do the same thing for housing, to make it so that there's permanently affordable housing that's woven into our world, that's not conflict-oriented, that I see a lot of these developers going and saying, okay, I'm going to do a few of my units, whatever it is, as affordable housing. I hear it's a little bit of a wink-wink, nod-nod at the end of the day. 25 years later, they're not that affordable anymore. They've been sort of gypped out and sort of pulled out of the system. They were built with conflict. One of the things I love about the Foundation House idea is there's no conflict. That's what the building is for. That's what the board is there to serve, is a particular user community. And if the nonprofits go away, pick another couple nonprofits. Pick the local school. Let's just help out teachers staying close to their schools. So if we can build a system such that not all of the housing becomes unaffordable all at once towards a particular sector, then I think we've got something that'll last. So I'd say it's similar to building these things. Let's just make them permanent this time.
On the eco village and that kind of thing, those are great things. I mean, and to live in that world, you have to be jar literate. You go in the cupboard and there's no processed food, and you have to know what's in the jar because there's no label. If you're not jar literate, you don't live in that world. If you don't have enough time to be jar literate and know to mix your bulgur with your other thing that doesn't have a name, but they know a name, then you don't have time to live that way. So we're reaching folks who have houses, who shop at Safeway, but they want some of this stuff. So, within the jar literate ghetto, it's a wonderful thing. We want to reach beyond that. And we know it's not like but other people are not going to think about their stuff that communally, and they want to be in some part of it. So you got to reach some folks who are not, who believe in walls. Folks in our deep network, have gun racks in their pickups. They're not thinking about property the way you are.
I'd like to say I cast aspersion at bankers, but I am one. I'm a chairman of a credit union, so if I know among what I speak, but just trying to do it a little differently.
I'll just say that I think co-ops are great, and the only reason that we didn't end up being a cooperative, I think, first of all, when we first got started, we were just a little cocky and wanted to be creative. But also at the moment, we have a nonprofit umbrella, and cooperatives are still for-profit entities. And but the government treats them differently. Rains is rolling his eyes because they usually are not very for profit at all.
Not by design, it's just the
right. But
way it works, or doesn't.
I think that the nonprofit structure, if we can I think it also gives us certain freedoms that are really interesting. We are technically, the way that we're structured at the Red Victorian is an LLC that's owned by a nonprofit. So it's this hybrid structure that, you know, an LLC, you can do whatever you want with an LLC. So you can effectively be a cooperative, which we are. But if I mean, it would be great if we had any profits left over, but if we did, they would go to the nonprofit, and that nonprofit stands for experimental placemaking.
Right.
And so I think that's a more flexible model, but the cooperative is in my heart.
And ours is going to be a nonprofit. It's being incubated in this kind of a new economy fab lab that Good Capital is happening, but it will become a nonprofit as it matures. So.
Unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program now where we have time for only one more question, which is a lady back here. And then I'm going to turn it over to each of our panelists to give us a closing comment. And hopefully in that closing comment, give us some advice for how we can begin to do this on our own as well without having to have a larger structure. But the lady here.
Hi, this question is for Brewster. I think the Foundation House is an incredible idea, and I was wondering if you could talk about any challenges you face besides acquiring funding in order to make that happen.
Challenges on the Foundation House. I think you should talk to Michelle and Roxana, because it's a little weird. It's kind of employee-oriented housing. It's a little peculiar. And so it takes a level of buy-in, if you will. And it's sort of a commitment, both of the organization to the employee and the employee to the organization. It's sort of not just as easy as like, I'm going to go work at the bakery down the street. Screw you. It's like, but then I have to leave my house. I'd say that's one of the things that's – it sort of comes with the package of like faculty housing or dorms in schools, but it's really unusual in this using it in the employee kind of space. What I like about it, though, in this characteristic is these big organizations, whether hospitals or monasteries, they have this infrastructure of having housing. But the little guys, the little nonprofits, I find in little nonprofits some of the most innovative, weird, cool, bonzo people out there. Let's see if we can provide a distributed infrastructure for those guys so that we can go and make it so that people can be entrepreneurs in the nonprofit space. Mm-hmm. But then getting back to it, I think the next question really is this going to spread or is it kind of an idea? And, you know, I don't know. But I love being here. This is like the second time I've ever gotten to speak about this. The first time was at SOCAP. I think we've got something concrete enough. It seems like there's some traction to this general idea, but I say it's in this mush, and San Francisco's great at coming up with new ideas.
Okay, well, I'd like to turn it over to each of our panelists now, and maybe we could start with Kevin Jones and then go to Jesse Kate and end with Brewster. I'd like to let your audience listening at home know tonight this is the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Open Source Housing for Good with Brewster Kahle, Kevin Doyle Jones, and Jesse Kate Shingler. So I will turn it over to Kevin now, and then Jesse and Brewster, and then we'll do our formal closing.
Well, in terms of following up on Brewster, what the challenges are, we have tons of inbound commitments, and we can sell more customers than we can handle, which I've been to before in a for-profit. So I'm raising what they call capacity money right now to enable me to build and us to build the network that people are already wanting to be in and pay to be in. So it's a little bit of, you know, momentum can be a terrible thing. And a lot of businesses don't survive their initial success, you know. And so I've been at other businesses like that, and we need to build the capacity to deal with all the inbound. So I'm out asking, having lunch with people, trying to raise the operating, you know, unrestricted operating money to make it happen, because more people want it than we can deliver.
Jesse Kate.
Well, in terms of you were asking about, you know, how do more people go and do this type of housing themselves. I think that it is challenging because it's not your typical, like, you just go and put a deposit on a one-bedroom space. So you really do need kind of a crack team of people that you're going to start this project with. I mean, it's a project. Something with a bigger scale is going to take a little bit more work, and it's going to take some more dollars as well. Just on a really pragmatic level, I think we found that if you know you want to start a project like this, go and talk to people about contributing to your project and supporting your project financially first. Don't wait until you found a place in San Francisco that's going to be gone in 10 minutes. You know, have it lined up so that you can kind of present a really solid front to whether it's a landlord or a real estate agent. Kind of have your stuff together. I would say the other thing that has been pretty common that I've seen is people will often try and get an entire group together. If you're looking for, you know, a 10-bedroom house, people will try and get 10 people together and then try and find a property. Right. And that doesn't work. It's not that those 10 people, you know, can't be great friends, but that probability of finding 10 people and then finding a property that works for all those 10 people is extremely low. But finding two or three people who share a vision, finding a property, and then filling it with people, especially in a place like San Francisco, is going to be a lot easier. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of demand for shared housing like this. So having a clear kind of what do we stand for as a community and sort of some basic, like, what's in and what's out, you know, that provides a really powerful kind of spine for building a community around.
Brewster?
So the next steps for us would be seeing if it can grow up a bit. And some of the things that would be useful is people that would like to be leaders in this type of thing and do the hard work of trying to pull things together. There's some talk with different folks in different cities or community foundations that see this as a problem that they would like a solution to, basically the supporting nonprofit workers, or even finding locations that are really prime. San Francisco has got more opportunities going on now that the city's really busy. But I love Richmond, California. Dealing with the officials in Richmond, California has been fabulous. They answer on the first ring. They say yes as often as they can. They're awesome. So maybe there's other places that would be good places to go and build some of these alternative structures that would be really warm and friendly towards these sorts of work. So looking for ideas, and people would say, I've got a related thing. We should do something.
Kevin Jones, any last words?
Yeah, just you made me think of it. I'm part of a network that's looking at housing. Well, in Nashville, we're looking, Asheville, North Carolina, we're looking for subsidized housing for musicians. They figured it out in Nashville, and they figured out both subsidized housing in Nashville, it's for songwriters. So it's vital to the community, but they can't make a living. Same with musicians in Asheville, vital to the community. And in Austin, they figured out both subsidized housing for musicians. They've also figured out collective health insurance for musicians. So it's like it can extend to those kinds of places where people want those folks to stay. Sometimes it's nonprofit people. Other places, it can be artists who are vital to the community.
Rock on.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
hook up with those things.
Thank you to our panelists here today. Thank you to our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and our audience listening at home. Our program today has been Open Source Housing for Good with Brewster Kahle, Kevin Jones, and Jesse Kate Shingler. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I've been your host for tonight. And with this, I would like to thank you all for attending the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion. And with this, our program tonight is closed.
None of those cities are thinking about 10 minutes in life.